Hi, my name is Polly Pistol, and I'm an alcoholic. By God's grace, in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink since April the 11th of 1977. And thank you. And I'm so grateful to be here. And I just thank Dick and Barbara and the opportunity to be here, because Dave and I have been here for 5 years, because I messed up the first year. And I'm just so delighted to be here, and I feel so honored. I can't even begin to tell you how honored I feel to be standing here or sitting at this table with Clancy and Bob. I'm like, you know, how do you get from there to here? I don't know. But what I kind of was talking to Dick about it, and he says, well, what would you give, you know, what kind of Christmas gift or what would you give to people? And we were talking about down there with Clancy, and so what I was trying to just think of, and then when I was at dinner tonight, my new sponsor said, Polly, you're always talking about great events have come to pass. And that's the great fact for us all. And I know not everybody in here has 37 years of sobriety and has been in this program for a while, because we just saw somebody with 2 days that's been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the things that I pray for you if you're new here is I pray that you came here with desperation. And that's a gift. I didn't understand that that was a gift, but that was a great gift. That was a great event and a great gift that came to pass, was a gift of desperation. Because what it did was what Clancy was talking about last night. It gave me the ability to listen to people tell me what to do when I didn't know what to do, and listen and follow direction. That was a great event that came to pass. And I've got introduced to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want, you know, I'm one of these people, I always love to be around when Linda talks, because when Linda talks, she talks about being an only child and her parents loved her so much. And that was my experience. And then I was a military wife. And I'm here to tell you there's nobody in the military that I know of that I was with that's in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I came to AA, I didn't even know an alcoholic. I didn't even know another alcoholic. And I had no idea that what was wrong with me was alcoholism. I knew that I was mentally ill. I'd been told that many times. I mean, I had so many military doctors giving me all kinds of tranquilizers and barbiturates to keep the hysterical woman quiet. And so what happened for me is I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I came through a treatment center, and they introduced me to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. What happened for me was another great event that came to pass, and that was that a sponsor that would become the man who would become my first sponsor 12-stepped me out of a motel room in Euless, Texas, and brought me into a detox center and saved my life. And he became my sponsor, and I'm so grateful for that. And when I was 5 years, well, when I was 3 years sober, I married another member of this fellowship. And Dave and I, oh honey, you are such a great event that's come to pass. And Dave and I in October celebrated 34 years of marriage. And let me tell you, this morning when he was standing up here at this podium, I looked at Hillary and I said, he's just so damn cute, I can't stand it. And I just, you know, it's been absolutely wonderful. And we've had, you know, between us, we got 4 drug addicted alcoholics and, you know, alcoholics and drug addicts. And, you know, you put these 4 kids together, and when you get married, these stepkids, and you say, what an order, I can't go through with it. And it's just been an amazing, amazing journey. And I was privileged. When Dave and I were 5 years, when I was 5 years sober and Dave was 6 years sober, we had the privilege of moving to Southern California. Now, I got sober in Texas, and I believe to this day that, I hate to say this, Atlanta, because this is a lot, this is absolutely a pocket of enthusiasm, but I got sober in Texas, and in my opinion, there's no better AA than Texas and California. I mean, I want you to know that they absolutely get it on. And one of the things I love to be sitting here. here at this table, because Clancy would come to spoke every year at our meeting at Monday night Seal Beach speakers meeting. And it seemed like, Clancy, every time you came to speak, our piano player was out. And Clancy would play the Happy Birthday on the piano for us. And these are just things that we did. You know, you sing Happy Birthday, and most of us move from place to place, and you have to introduce them that you sing Happy Birthday when you have an anniversary or whatever, because they don't do that. So that's been a great event that's come to pass, is that when I was 5 years sober, I got to move to Southern California, and I got to have AA. And I'm just telling you right now, if you're new and you're sitting in this room and you're from this surrounding area, this is a pocket of enthusiasm. Soak it up. Soak it up. Because I will assure you, I've had the opportunity, and I feel like it's a gift, that I know the difference between a pocket of enthusiasm and not. And it's so amazing to be here in this kind of AA. I absolutely love it. And when I had heard my second AA sponsor, when I was 3 years sober, I had heard her speak in Austin, Texas. And I said, if I ever get anywhere where this lady is, I'll ask her to sponsor me. And what happened is we moved to Southern California when I was 5 years sober. And I met Dottie. And she became my sponsor, and she was my sponsor for 32 years. Another great event that has come to pass is that I believe in sponsorship. I am a firm believer in sponsorship. I would not be standing here sober with the enthusiasm and the passion, the absolute passion that I have for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, if it had not been for sponsorship. And I knew that I needed a sponsor. I can't be sponsorless. And God was already... I loved last night when Clancy was talking about the history of AA and how every little brick, if any little brick would have been out of place, none of us would be here tonight. And what happens is I know God is always orchestrating my life. I don't know that that's happening, but he's always orchestrating my life. And that little brick had been laid, and I met my sponsor that I have today, Rena. I met her 3 years ago in Columbus, Ohio, of all places. And you know, it was just that magic. And today, I was without a sponsor for 2 weeks, and I asked Rena, and I have a sponsor. The other thing that I want to quickly mention is that that's a great gift and a great event that's come to pass, but at the time it didn't seem like a great gift. And that was when I was 5 years sober, and I'd only been in Southern California maybe about five or six months, maybe a little less. And what was happening is both of my sons, one of my sons has a lot of mental illness, and he was just trying to commit suicide. In fact, he tried to commit suicide for 10 times until I was 10 years sober. And I thought, I am going to die with what's happening. My other son was dying from the disease of alcoholism. And I ended up going to an AA meeting. And I was in that AA meeting, and they asked for somebody to share, and I had my hand raising like crazy, and I told them that my daughter-in-law had called, and that my son was in the hospital and put a pair of scissors in his stomach. And I just was so torn down. And this old man in the back of the room, he says, just hollered out, "You need to turn those boys over." And I flew out of that chair. I'm sure none of you have had that kind of rude behavior in an AA meeting. But I flew out of that chair, and I said, "You want to tell me how to do that?" And, of course, he didn't know. But when the student's ready, the teacher will appear. And the reason I'm sharing this is because this conference is family recovery. And what happened is this lady walked up to me, and she was a double winner. And she says, "Polly, I need to take you to an Al-Anon meeting." And that next day, I went to an Al-Anon meeting, and those women gathered around me, and they said, "Polly, you of course you feel the way you feel. You're a mother." And they said, "But what we're going to show you how to do is we're going to show you how to love your sons without it killing you." And I know without a single doubt that I was in so much pain, but God sent me the very answer that I needed was to send me to an Al-Anon meeting, because those ladies saved me that day because of that kind of pain. And I am so grateful for the program of Al-Anon. I am so grateful for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, to the God that you gave me. I came into the rooms with this little bitty God, and I was terrified. I was raised Southern Baptist. I was terrified. And you introduced me to this huge God that loves me so much, allows me to have sponsees, lets other women want what I have, and for that I'm grateful. Thank you.
And our next wise member is Bob B. from Minneapolis, or from St. Paul.
I'm Bob Bazans. I'm an alcoholic. Sober through the grace of God in AA since the 10th of December, 1967. For that, I'm very grateful. I don't know what to say. That's very cool being here this weekend. Something special about this time of year. One of the nice things about what you've done, Richard, it's a gift that keeps on giving when you start a conference. You know, it's kind of like a gift to the community. I'm up here on a podium with a woman who does more talking than any other woman in AA, and a man who's talked to more alcoholics than any person in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just kind of an interesting panel to be on. If I was talking about the gifts of AA, one of the questions that comes to my mind is, what else is there? What else is there? I was, a buddy of mine died 6 months ago. Is this thing still reverberating, Lee? Okay. A buddy of mine died about 6 months ago, and he and I were running mates for 44 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we did everything together. We were stark raving sober. He was about 2 years behind me, and we just bonded and went out. And I was the only guy. It was kind of funny. It was weird. He ran our intergroup, Helen, in Minneapolis. His name was Chuck Rice. And Chuck and I, especially in our early sobriety, were not very good husbands, and we're not very good family people, because we were just so taken up in Alcoholics Anonymous and so centered in our recovery that we wanted to be everywhere, and we were everywhere. And when you're at a funeral, as I've been at a number of them, where you have people who are so active, whose families had gained so much in some ways and given so much in other ways, it's a funny thing. And I started to see when I saw Chuck. Chuck was kind of rough around the edges. He was in Boys Town in reform school. And he ended up being a guy who, you know, he and I started to go for state. He gave so many things to the AA community. And I was thinking, Linda and I winter someplace. We get away from Minnesota. And often when you're sober a long time, people find out you're an AA and they say, you're an alcoholic? I say, yeah. How long have you been sober? They sometimes ask, and I say, well, you know, 45 years, 46 years. They say, do you still go? I say, yes, I still go. Why? And, you know, it's a hard question to answer to someone who can't contain the answer. When you've been a person who was born with a fair amount of gifts, and you've never been able to use those gifts, and everything you started out to do turns to mud, and you are as confused as anybody else when you walk into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous for why your life is such a failure. It feels like a built-in failure mechanism. And you hurt everybody you touch. You hurt your parents, you hurt your brothers and sisters, you hurt your employers, you hurt your spouse, you hurt your children, you are a cloud everywhere you go. And then you find your thing. You find your instrument. And all of a sudden, you're taken from that spot where everything you touch turns to mud to where you stop digging the hole. And all of a sudden, whatever you touch, you go from a taker to a giver. And it's like, the 10 lepers. When Christ looked over and said, I healed 10. Where's only one returned? Why wouldn't you return? Where else is there to go? I mean, this is your place. And not everybody's supposed to be as active as some of us are. But I think most of us, if we, especially this time of year, most of us know that something has touched our lives and healed us. That something has happened to us that we did not make happen. Something has happened to us that we don't control. Something has happened to us that is bigger than we are, and you can't really explain it. It is a gift. It is unmerited. And it is profound. And so most of us, when we're talking to people who don't have much understanding about Alcoholics Anonymous, you can't really give the real answer about what has happened to our lives and what has so clearly happened that we couldn't have done it ourselves. And this is our place. This is where we maintain our spiritual condition. This is where we celebrate it. This is where we gather annually around the campfire to have the conversation we're having tonight. So it's a really cool thing. And it's a conversation that we sometimes have trouble keeping going because we are mind-bound. And we pop in and we pop out. The longer we're around, most of us do a better job of staying in the conversation. But mostly, the conversation is not constant. We don't know very many people who are able to maintain their spiritual condition constantly. And that's one of the reasons we gather around the campfire to tell the same story over and over and over again. It's like we're like little children whose parents are reading the book and tired and they skip a page and the kid says, no. You skipped a page. You have to go back and you have to say the same words. I was a kid from a nice family, one of seven kids, lovely mother and father. I was born on third base. I've been congratulating myself for hitting a triple. And but I was a guy who, even though I was well equipped for the business of living life, I was a guy who started to fail at everything that I touched. I was an insecure kid, 4'11" in high school. I started to compensate, had a big mouth, found alcohol, loved everything that it did to me. And I just started my downhill run. And I mistreated everybody that I could lay my hands on. I was the family problem. I gutted my mother and father. I mean, walked out of Notre Dame in the middle of my senior year. Gave up my commission in the Army for alcoholism, diagnosed as an alcoholic when I was 19 years old. Car accidents, some arrests, just a series of failures. Just a person that you just wouldn't want to be involved in. And I was as confused about what was going on in my life as anybody else was confused about what was going on in my life. My gift was the gift that Polly talked about. My gift was my collapse. If we ask most of us in the room, what's your biggest gift, most of us would say our recovery. But what our biggest gift is our collapse. Our collapse is where we got broken open. Our collapse, many of us had hit bottom before, and some of us, when we hit bottom, we got a ladder and started to crawl out of the hole. But on the day when you hit bottom and a trap door opened and you kept going, where there was nothing else, and that day something magical happened. All of a sudden, the person that wasn't open, wasn't teachable, couldn't hear anything, you couldn't say anything to them, all of a sudden, that person is going to 4 or 5 meetings a week, asking a question, getting a sponsor, starting to do things that they, under any set of circumstances, would never do. So my first gift, without knowing it, was my collapse. My second gift was we had a central office, and I called central office and got the old timer on the phone that ran central office. My third gift was two men who showed up at a cafe on a Thursday night in July of 1967 and made a 12-step call on me. My parents had put me in front of every kind of help that a person could possibly be put in front of, professionals. But I'd never been put in front of another person who had a drinking problem. One guy was 6 months, one guy was 6 years, sat me down and said, "We're from Alcoholics Anonymous. We had a drinking problem. We want to share it with you. Hope it helped you. If it doesn't, don't worry about it. It helps us talking to guys like you." And they told me their story. The gift in their telling me their story is they altered my life. They altered my life. That night I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I drank twice after, once 30 days sober, once almost 90 days sober. I went to my first meeting, 30 men, two women, and I met my sponsor. Actually, met my two sponsors. I had one man that asked me to sponsor him at that first meeting, and he was always kind of my shadow sponsor, and we were friends. But my main sponsor, Warren McGinley, got sober in July of 1954. And he was the 12-step champion of the Uptown group of Alcoholics Anonymous. He probably touched and saved 200 lives. I don't even know what the number is, but if I was forced to put a number to it, I would say that that's 200. He was a very, very ordinary man. He was a mailman. He was a Second World War vet, lost half his crew in Italy in a bomb disposal squad. And he was my big book. He wasn't a guy that you'd come to give the fancy talk at an AA conference, although he gave a fine talk. He just was my big book. His wife was Linda's sponsor. In the 43 years that we were together, never in 43 years that we called Zit, were in the neighborhood, could we come over? Never did they say no. With kids, fighting, without kids, never. They were quite a couple. And he sat me down in a chair and said, "Bob, alcoholism is a disease." I did not know that. Physical, mental, spiritual, once you're crossing the line from problem drinking to alcoholism, your alcoholism affects you all the time when you're drinking and when you're not drinking. Most of us, I think, are shocked to find out that our alcoholism affects us when we're not using. That was a rocket science kind of thing. He also told me we quit one day at a time. Thought that was kind of a trick that Sheldon talked about. He said, once we drink or our last drug, we use the 12 recovery steps to change, to find a different way to live that's sufficiently better than the way we lived before, so we don't have to go back to drugs or booze to do something for us that we were unwilling or unable to do for ourselves. If you don't change, you won't stay. Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was on a honeymoon for the first nine months of my sobriety. My gift is I have loved Alcoholics Anonymous from the moment I walked in the front door. It's been hard for me to do the work, but it's been easy for me to stay, which is a gift beyond all understanding, because some of the most significant changes that I was defined necessary to make, I didn't make until I was sober 7 years. I got to be my sponsor's wingman and go out on many, many 12-step calls, talk in prisons, go to jails, go to other groups, detoxes, those sorts of things. So I got very active in service, and that was a gift that kept on giving. I found myself, I'm going to talk more about this tomorrow, I think when we come in unwittingly, we spend the first two or three years dealing with the consequences of our alcoholism and drug addiction. I think that, you know, and the work that we do is enormous. The the woods that we clear are enormous. We walk in here with a set of problems. We have been sowing manure seeds for 15 or 20 years before we come in here. Most of us have a pretty substantial crop, you know, when we walk in the door. And most of us are complaining because we don't think we planted those seeds and we don't think that's our crop. Okay. And it takes a while for us to discover that, you know, you see that picture of your life up there? You painted that. It takes a long time to really take full responsibility for the fact that you painted that. The bad news is you're 100% responsible. The good news is you can overpaint it. You can change it. You can alter it. That is, you are not dedicated to that. So my gifts were, I got active in service, and I started, and my other gift was, is in Minnesota, almost all our meetings are closed-step discussion meetings. So almost all our conversations, when I came in, 99, I never talked in my group for the first 25 years I was sober. We only had one open meeting a month, and we got outside speakers. All the other meetings, they were step discussion meetings. So the steps were the discussion that we were having all the way through. I had a significantly unmanageable life. I don't think horribly unmanageable for a 23-year-old, 24-year-old kid when I got sober. But it felt really unmanageable. Most of the people I was comparing myself to were those 50 and 60 and 70-year-old vets who had their lives put together pretty well. And my life looked like it was pretty fractured compared to most of these men. And then about that time, we started to get young people, the renaissance of treatment in Minnesota. I've been married 47 years. Linda, stand up. Without Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not be married, I don't believe. Without Al-Anon, I don't think I'd be married. I was a pretty rambunctious jerk, especially during the first 7 years of our marriage. I was married to a lover, which is why I'm still married. Without a mutual program, without when a problem really became a problem, without turning the lasers on each other, we wouldn't be together. I don't think there's much of a question about that. We have three sons that are, I know their names, I don't know how old they are. Let's see. 45, 43, and 35? 34. Oh, give me a break. They are sober, 26, 27, 23, and 16 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. My father had 20 years of sobriety with an interruption in the middle. I have a brother who has 30 years of sobriety, maybe 35. Of my seven or eight guys that I hung with in high school, five are in Alcoholics Anonymous and probably have an average of 35 years of sobriety. All of us have been married over 45 years. I live in the same town that I grew up in. So it is, you know, I'm constantly around people I went to grade school with, I went to high school with. I was a guy who did not know how to work. I had a gambling addiction. I was a money spender. I was a suit. I was a big shot. I didn't know much about life, and I really was kind of a mystery to me. I was pretty bright. But for a bright guy, I had no clue. I just had no clue. And I kept failing. I'm the guy you'd pick. I'd be on your team. I'd be one of the guys you'd select. But it wouldn't take you very long to figure out that there was nothing behind the suit. And I found myself at 7 years of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had a second collapse. This was a collapse of my life. I think the first time we come in, I didn't get the insight. I did a fist up, kind of like everything runs together. But I think it was Mari that talked about writing, you know, all the things that were troublesome in your life, the worst things that you had done. That was my first fist up. The fourth and fifth step that changed my life was at 7 or 8 years of sobriety. And the unmanageability of my life is 7 or 8 years. And I used to feel so badly about that, and now I think it's a common experience. I think that most of us clear out the boulders and eventually have to get around to the causes and conditions. Most of us don't get around to the causes and conditions until we have some insight, both into the steps and into ourselves. And that takes some ongoing interaction with the steps and some spiritual grounding and some spiritual growth. That second collapse was one of the largest gifts I've ever been given. At that point, I learned how to work. You'd think that I would have known how to work at 30 years of age. I did not know how to work or apply whatever gifts I had, and later was to do reasonably well in business. I quit gambling at 7 years of sobriety. I was a child abuser. I was copied what I grew up with, and as our society has developed, being physical with your children got more and more unacceptable, and something I was deeply ashamed of, and wasn't something I was able to deal with until I was sober almost 10 years. I was a loud, impatient, angry, immature, and sometimes violent father. I'm not proud of that, but that's the way I was. Can you imagine today how grateful I am to not have those significant difficulties in my life that was hurting the people? We talk about making amends. How would you like to have 5 or 6 years of sitting down with your children saying, "I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry about that. That will change." The conversation Sheldon talked about. It's one thing to do it with an employer. It's another thing to look into your children's eyes as you are about to slap them or spank them or whatever the hell it is. And, until you know better, you can't do better. And this was my school. And so the gift I was given when I walked in the door, the gift of my collapse and the gift of my sobriety, the gifts I've been given was like the nesting dolls in Russia. Inside of every gift was another box, was another gift, was another box, was another gift, was another box, was another gift. And without trying to sound too corny, it ends up that that's all there is. Because as Sheldon and Mari and Terry and everybody else who's talked here this weekend talked about, you can't do it yourself, which is the story that we're talking about. The whole conversation that we've been having, the red thread that has gone through every conversation that we've had, when Bob was talking about step 1, 2, and 3, we can't. I can't. We can. I can't. We can. And that power, interestingly enough, works best in our weakness, which is an old story. Paul had that story. And when we empty ourselves out and make a space, when we empty ourselves out on that collapse, when we empty ourselves out on that surrender, we can receive the gift. When you're an egg, there's no entry point. You can't receive. Okay? You can leave a poster on the outside of the egg, but the the egg doesn't ever get the message. So until we're broken open, and once you've been broken open and you've received that gift, there is a sense of joy. There is a tremendous sense of freedom. But there's no sense of accomplishment in that moment. There's just a sense of redemption. And that's what we gather around to hear. I mean, it's a story of both redemption and it's a story of transformation. It is... Today in our stories, we talk a hell of a lot more about sobriety. When I first came in, almost all the AA talks were drunkalogs. They started with your first drink, ended with your last, and had 5 minutes at the end of the talk for the wife, the kids, and the job. But the people who gave those stories were so skilled in their communication, you clearly understood the transformation that had happened in their lives. And then people like Chamberlain and Cecil and other people started to change the communication within Alcoholics Anonymous, and in the AA talk started to be included some talks on recovery and some talks on the steps and some talks on spirituality. Chamberlain almost single-handedly, in my opinion, altered the communication in Alcoholics Anonymous. And later, there started to be more of a conversation about what happens in sobriety. And that's a delicate walk, because if you talk too much about what just happens in sobriety, you have the danger of going into psychology rather than recovery. And that doesn't have the power. It has some insight, and it's interesting, but it doesn't have the strength, and it doesn't have the power. And we need always to be attached to the surrender. We always need to be attached to the powerlessness. The thing that attaches to us better than anything else is working with others, is having that eyeball-to-eyeball conversation. In the eyeball-to-eyeball conversations, you don't need any deep conversation. All you need is your own experience. And that's the gift that we give each other. When we gather together and bring our damp logs of the bonfire of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we sit down in our seats and say, tell me the story one more time. And each one of us has a very different story. And it is something that just keeps on giving. And it allows me to have a life that is happy and usefully whole that I was never able to have before. It allows me to live life on life's terms. It allows me to be present. It allows me not to strike children. It allows me to be in love with my wife. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. There are many people in this room that have changed our lives, but Bob and Linda have been just incredible presence in our lives, as Dave and Polly. When my sponsor, Bill Roop, was dying, he knew he was dying, and we've talked about it today, what do you do when you're getting ready to lose a sponsor? And I'd known Bill had been my sponsor for 33 years. And he picked out my next sponsor, and incredibly, there wasn't any big gap in there, and this man has been supportive of me for a long, long time. And welcome, Clancy.
My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. Just before the meeting started, Dick said, you each have 15 minutes now to talk. You've left me 7. Thank you. But we'll get out on time. It's been a very good weekend for me. I've unfortunately been physically ill. I was in bed all afternoon, wheezing and sneezing, and I got some stuff that makes it better. But something, Bob's got it too, and I guess we got something in Spain last week that dreadful. Outside of the Spanish people, they're dreadful. But I don't judge them. There's been a little talk this weekend about Sandy Beach, whose 50th birthday is tomorrow, a nice guy. I knew him when he was first sober in Washington, D.C., because I knew one of his friends, Hal Marley, and another, there were three of them, Hal Marley and Sandy and Ed Nixon, who used to run around together, and they were quite a team up there. But last fall, I was in Tampa, Florida, for something or somewhere, St. Petersburg or someplace, and I called. I talked to Sandy's daughter, and I said, "I'd like to come by and see him if it isn't too much bother." She said, "Oh, he'd love to see you. Great." So I went over there, and we spent the afternoon. I cheered him up a little bit, I think, and we laughed and talked. And he told me a funny little anecdote. There's no point to it, but something to take home. He said, Clancy, I had a funny dream last night. I dreamt that I was dead, and I was at the pearly gates trying to get in, and they would not let me in. I said, why don't you let me in? He said, St. Peter said, because you're not on the list. He said, but I'm a friend of Bill Wilson. I said, he's not on the list either. So you can take that home and think about that for a while. But I was thinking about certain things. I talked pretty much what I wanted to say the other night. But Christmas is coming, and Christmas has always been a kind of a bugaboo for a lot of people in AA because we want more out of it than there is in it. And one of the few things that I started to do when I was new, I was very happy. I had nothing, and so I had to play down Christmas a lot. But I was about, I don't know, 2 years sober. I wasn't doing very well, had no front teeth, had old clothes, and had a little job that I was working on. But somebody called the club and said, this is West Covina. We need somebody to speak at our Christmas Eve meeting. Our speaker canceled. Do you know anybody? Yes, I do. So I hustled a clean jacket and a clean shirt and a tie from somebody and got another guy to give me a ride out there about 30 miles. It was the basement of an old rundown American Legion Hall with tattered direct decorations and the tree half tipped over. Just dreadful. And I went in and these little people sitting there, just looked like God's waiting room. You know. And I thought, I probably could give an honest talk out here. I said, you know, Christmas is really crappy. When I was a kid, it was nice, but I grew up near where Bob grew up, and snow and ice and sleds and things, and Christmas Eve would go to my grandmother's house and a lot of big family and wait for my aunt and uncle to come down from Minneapolis, and then we'd celebrate the presents, get the presents out, and in the middle of the Depression, there wasn't much presents, but people made them like something. And I always wanted a pony. I never got a pony. But I got a sled one time, and I got a little electric train. And I still remember my memory of Christmas Eve is my dad pulling me on my sled home from Grandma's house and the snow wind coming down, and I just clutching my gifts. And now I said Christmas turned into just a financial hustle for everybody in the world trying to hustle dough on Christmas. And I had five little kids in Dallas. I had four little kids at that time, and I had sent them some presents. I worked hard and got a few bucks, and I got some little animals, a bear and a lion, and I sent them each one with a little poem around the wind, and one I was going to send, and I couldn't, because it was a little lion that was sewed about a quarter of an inch off all the way around. So instead of going, I thought, that looks like me. I mean, I look good at a distance, but up close, I'm sewed together wrong. So I kept that line, and he's at the head of my bed for the next 40 years. But anyway, I told him this story, and I thought Christmas is crappy, and we're all wasting our time here. And at the end of the meeting, I thought, see if they're going to throw me out. The guy goes, that was a wonderful message. Could you talk again next year? I said, sure. So I came out next year, and doing a little bit better. I had a job, and I had some decent clothes. I still had no front teeth, but I learned to talk like this pretty well. And I told him, I started off with the same theory, but I said, now it's getting a little bit better. I try to explain how it gets a little bit better. And this went on for years. 1980, I was out there for the 20th time. I was talking about, it used to be crappy, and I wanted certain things. I never got what I wanted, but and a guy sitting right there named Harvey Andrews jumped up and said, I can't stand it! I can't stand any more of this! And he ran out the door. Which was bad enough, except I was his sponsor. I said, what the hell's wrong with you, Harvey? So I tried to pick up the tattered ends of my few remarks, and he came walking in leading a pony. He says, here's your goddamn pony, change your story! You ought to hear the tape of that being, you just hear a scream. All of there's 600 or 700 people there. Like, as he led down the aisle, and there's this pony, ugly little pony, Shetland pony. And that little red thing, I said, Clancy's pony. I thought, well, that's a cute joke. And I was speechless for a while, but I picked it up. And at the end of the meeting, I thought to myself, that was kind of a cute little joke. So he got a pony somewhere and ran it into bring it into me. And the secretary got up and he thanked his coffee makers and he talked to people to set up the meeting. And he read the name of the 10 guys who had purchased the pony for the speaker. And the next day, a trailer backed up to my garage in West LA and here's this pony getting up. It was a lot better in the abstract than it was real. I know how to treat a pony. I said, get over there. But I see that he had a hard life because when I moved fast, he'd hide. He apparently had been beaten a lot. So I got Harvey Andrews to come out, and he built me a stable back in my garage. We had a stable. That pony lived in our backyard for many, many years. You know, on Saturday, people come over to my yard every Saturday, have been since 1968, I guess, playing ball and having a picnic every Saturday. About 100 people, AAs, come over and play volleyball and softball and have a picnic, have a good time. First of all, the first activity is that we have two or three people we trust with wheelbarrows to go around the yard, and the newcomers get shovels to take care of the what's left of the seven dogs who live out there all week. But when we had a pony, that really was something. In fact, people always talk, I'm not going to go over that guy's yard and shovel crap. But if they fall into my hands, they will. The only person that ever escaped that was a guy named Buzz Aldrin, who was an astronaut. And he had a degree from MIT and had been to the moon. And he jumped ahead right to being a pointer. He was out in front. Here's one. And he was proud of it. But I've always thought a little bit about Christmas, because I'm down deep, always been terribly sentimental and emotional. And I dream about Christmases that never were. You know, oh, they were wonderful. They really weren't so wonderful at all. It's like the good old days. There's a phenomenon in human behavior. It's called dynamic memory, which is the tendency of the human brain to soften unpleasant memories and enhance pleasant memories. That's why every generation has good old days 25 years ago. Boy, they were really the good old days. But we all live in the same way. I think sometimes about Christmas, I think the better part of life is really New Year's, because A is more like New Year's. On New Year's, you know, we can make New Year's Eve, we make resolutions. Going to stop smoking, going to stop talking bad, going to not drink so much coffee, going to go to work on time. And it sometimes lasts 5 or 6 days before you slide out of that. But the great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous that struck me about 30 years ago is that every night is New Year's Eve, and every morning is New Year's Day. And tonight when I go to bed, I may make a few resolutions about what I'm going to act tomorrow. And if I act out, it'll be fine. If I don't, well, I got tomorrow night, I can make some resolutions about that. And so every day of AA, it's because most of us are not having achieved the great spiritual heights that many of our speakers have. I've always been a rather simple person. I'm in the simplicity school of AA. I always think it was the Dr. Bob school of keeping it simple. Just do what you're supposed to do and try to be nice and try to do what you're supposed to. And in our group, we have kind of a little chant, not a chant, but it's kind of a rigmarole that we tell newcomers that the great spiritual values you learn here are: do what you said you would do, be where you said you would be when you said you would be there. Don't take out your hostility on people who can't answer back, waiters and employees. On bad days, when you're having a bad day, keep your mouth shut. Because no matter how wonderful you are, when you feel bad, you can unlash a lot. Be a temperance! What you have to do then is just shut your eyes and say, come on, midnight. Come on, midnight. Because there isn't a person in the world, no human being that I've ever heard of, who doesn't have crappy days once in a while. And you can spot them by 10 o'clock in the morning. Jesus, it's a crappy day. And they all know it except me, and they're all acting bad. Come on, midnight. Some years ago, but AA has brought me some great rewards. Some years ago, as most of you know, I was expelled from the university probably 2 weeks before I got my diploma. So not my fault. Some woman had taken advantage of me. I'd never been touched. He was an old black comedian is what he was. What was his name? Anyway, I was expelled. My mother and father, I was their only child. They were divorced. They cried a lot. As Bob just said, he gutted his parents. I think that's a very good phrase. I gutted my parents. I certainly did. And as I got into AA and eventually listened to a sponsor and became somewhat successful and finally got some good jobs and made some money and got front teeth and smiled a lot. If any of you are new who have lost teeth, let me give you some hope. Once you become perfect, they grow back. When I was 15 years old, 15 years sober in AA, Bob and I have many things in common in a sense. We both have children in AA. I have three of my daughters turned 25 this summer in AA, and only one of them has turned out bad. She's a judge. Remember, she came home for Christmas some years ago and said, "Daddy, when we were little girls and you had tried to stop drinking, you used to send us to our room all the time." I said, "You know that. You understand that." She said, "Sure I do, Daddy. But when you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room." I've never been near New Mexico since then, I'll tell you that. But when I got to be 15 years sober, I was doing quite well. I own a big home out by the ocean. My kids were all, some of them were in college, some were planning to go to college. All my kids have graduated from college and doing well. And I tried to become a good father to them, and I guess we have, because as we've all grown old together, we've got closer and closer and love each other a great deal. My second oldest daughter just retired as the head of the biology department in some big school in New Mexico, and she's moved in with me now. She's my housekeeper since my wife passed away. And we both, it's unusual that I'd get along with a grown-up kid very well, but we get along very well, very wonderful. But anyway, I was thinking, somewhere in my early sobriety, I had learned something. And I don't know why I didn't pay much more attention to it. But it's something that I think is very important. Why do we stay sober? What's the purpose of sobriety? What are we here for? Stay sober forever. Just get drier and drier and drier until one day a wind blows you away. And it took me a while to realize it's something that's so obvious. The purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is steps, it's meetings, it's actions, its involvements, its sponsorship, is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast, to change my perception of reality, to make me confident, to make me live in the world with some degree of self-worth, to get jobs that I can hold and do not have to always prevail upon people to believe something that's not quite true. And I was about 15 years sober, and I thought, you know, I don't know anybody really that came from further down than me and came up this high this fast. Because I really came thrown out of a skid row mission the last day I drank with my teeth kicked out. It was about as low as you can get in this world. And I thought, I really should be doing something more for AA. I'm sponsoring people and I'm doing a lot of things and I say yes to everything they ask of me. But I should be doing more. So, as I've said many times through a series of odd situations, I left my job in Beverly Hills, and for the last 40 years, I've run the mission on Skid Row that threw me out in 1958. And people say to me, "Why would you give up your great career in Beverly Hills to run that crappy mission?" And there's no good answer for that. Well, it was such a significant decrease in salary, I couldn't pass it up. So Monday morning, next Monday morning, I'll do something that none of you will do. I'm sure I'll get up in my nice big house out by the ocean and jump in my car and drive through Beverly Hills where I used to work and get to Skid Row, this vast hellhole in the part of town, and park my car underneath a building so nobody will steal it. Take my morning walk around the mission. I'll see who's died since I've been gone, because they die out there. They have terrible time. They smash their face into the sidewalk in convulsions and overdose on that damn crack. It's just dreadful. And it's an enormous killing field. Then I'll go to the mission, and my staff and I will discuss how we can get these poor bastards off the street before they die. Because it's almost impossible to get people off Skid Row. When I first went down there, I was full of zeal. I'll get them a job, I'll get them some clothes, I'll get them a place to live, and a week later they're back on the street again, laying drunk on the street. It took me quite a while to realize the nature of Skid Row. The nature of Skid Row is this. Among other things they have in common, one of the most important things, they have lost the ability to live with conflict. Conflict that we take every day, just waiting for a bus, waiting for a conflict. But when they get conflict, they immediately run into alcohol or drugs or physically away. And it's almost impossible to get them off the street. So in our mission, what we've done now, we have a series of classes. We have 200 guys living in there. And they are, or 275 guys now, living in there, going to classes to learn how to not run away when you get upset. Doesn't that sound silly? They call it rehabilitation, but it isn't rehabilitation. It is habilitation. There's no re to it. I mean, they've been losers since they were born. But it's a wonderful feeling. And when I was there about 4 or 5 years, in 1979, I got a call from the University of Wisconsin, from the chancellor's office. The dean that had expelled me had now become chancellor. And this girl said, the chancellor knows that he and you are not very close, but perhaps for old time's sake, you could help us. We were supposed to have an alumni luncheon in Los Angeles next week, and the man that's supposed to have it all together, it turns out he's dead. Nobody ever told us. Now we have all these people coming, we have no place to go. Could you possibly help us? I said, I'll call you back. And I called him back in about an hour. I said, how about the Coconut Grove, where at night all the movie stars go and live it up, and you could have it for lunch? How's that? Oh, wonderful. I didn't tell her that I just sponsored the manager. It wasn't as difficult. But they came out and had this nice luncheon, and well, before I hung up, I said, but I have to be invited, even though I'm not an alumnus. I want to be invited. She said, I'll call you back. She called me, I said, yes, if we have you can come. So the chancellor and I were talking at the lunch. She says, what's this I hear about you running some sort of a place to help people? I said, yeah, I do. He said, that's not like you. You're a very self-centered, selfish person. It's one of the most I've ever known. I can't imagine you helping people unless there's something in it for you. I said, well, I suppose there is indirectly, but that's not good enough for me. I want to see this place. I want to see it in all its pristine purity. I want to go over there now, you and I. I don't want you to call them and tell them we're coming. Let's go see it. I said, okay. Sunday afternoon, everything was sparkling clean. Old guys on the street, hi, Mr. Clancy, hi, Mr. Clancy. He walked into my office, had some awards that I've gotten. He said, I can't believe this. It's the closest thing, a miracle since Jesus replaced Lazarus on the earth. I can't believe this. But that was the end of that. At least I'd done something. The next June, or next February, I got a call from the university again, from his secretary, saying, did you know that the chancellor is retiring in June? I said, no, but I wish him well. She said, and he has named you Distinguished Alumnus of the Year. Can you come back and speak at commencement? You bet I can, baby. I went back and spoke at commencement, brought all my kids with me so they could see the historic places where their parents came from. And we had a good time, wonderful. My mother and father were both at that convocation, both sat in bar awake crying, and their little boy turned out all right finally. And that was the end of that, But I couldn't let well enough alone. The next year, I sent the alumni department, a note saying, is it really right to have the alumnus of the year who's not really an alumnus, who's an expelled student? They would be, well, the chancellor wanted that way. All right. I wrote him another one next year. Wrote funny little notes year after year. And finally, one day in the mail came my diploma. Here's your diploma. Stop writing your goddamn notes. And so if you ever come to my office in Los Angeles, you'll see something significant. Alumnus of the Year, 1980. Graduate, 1987. Now, those are the sort of little triumphs that you nurture to help you a little bit. And when I was new, I had terrible motives, but there was the biggest meeting in town. It was called the Brentwood meeting. And they had a little board of directors, like somebody, meetings to them, that made the decisions, and they appointed the new secretary. And I was 5 years sober now, and I had a good job, and I had front teeth, and I had good clothes, and I had a stooge on that committee. I said, Smokey, you go and introduce my name, see what happens. I saw him the next day. I said, well, did it work out? He said, no, it died for lack of a second. So I thought, well, that's the end of that. And so I guess I wasn't meant to be a secretary. Then about a month later, somebody says, over in Ohio Street, the little Tuesday night meeting has died. You know anybody wants to put a meeting in there? I said, yes, I do. And I took 12 tattered followers. We went over there, and I started the meeting, wrote a form, temporary format, and which we read last Wednesday night, still using it word for word. And first week, there were about 12 people there, and I gave a wonderful series of announcements. Next week, there were 25, and I gave a wonderful series of announcements. Next week, there were over 30, 32. I offended a lot of the people. We're back to 12 the next week. But little by little, it grew. And now, through not my fault, but because of the people who came in there, it's the largest meeting in the world, almost 1,000 people every Wednesday night. Some of you have been there. It said, don't clap. Start a love offering. And I go to that meeting. You know, there's no great thrill to being the founder anymore. I used to, it's Clancy now. Get in line. But it's a wonderful thing. I look back, if I have a legacy in AA, there'll be that meeting. A lot of people get sober there, not because of me, almost despite of me, but it's there, and I'm glad to see that. And I think of the great things that some people do that I know. Down there is John Lee. Stand up, John. I'm not married to you, but sit down. John Lee is single-handedly trying to introduce sober AAs, English AA, in Rio de Janeiro. And he takes a lot of crap down there. And I went down and spoke for him last year. And you get awful tired of people talking funny. Love is the answer, bitch. But I think of him going every down there, every day out there, trying to get a few more couple. Now he's in Sao Paulo and some other cities, trying to get some meetings started, which is really the groundwork of AA. I think I wouldn't be able to do anything like that. I talk a lot. And I have people that I sponsor that I admire. Many of them are doing better than I believe, spiritually. But at least we're all in the same book together. And the concept of AA is always the same. We forget this sometimes. We get wrapped up in our individual little stories and what we're here about. Alcoholics Anonymous is exactly the same in this room today as it was in Akron, Ohio, 1935. It isn't all the panoply and the conventions and the gifts and all this. It is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of being terminally different, at least enough so that he will take an action he does not yet believe in. And when that happens, a little ember starts, and then you got to kind of blow on it. And you got to stay surrounded by people who feel the same way. Stay away from the sharpshooters and the cynics and the snots. And eventually you keep doing it, and one day you get the ember turns into a little campfire in your gut, and the rest of your life, as long as you have a camp, you have a little fire. You don't have to be a fanatic. It's just a little fire that you know that keeps you warm. And the one other thing, somebody asked me the other day, this is the last time I'm talking about it. He said, why do old-timers get drunk when it gets better year after year? Why do old-timers get drunk? Think about that. Why would they get drunk? And I don't know, but I'll tell you why I think. About 20 years ago, I went through a little spell where I was sick of AA. I was sick of the whiners and the liars and the cheats and the bad type of newcomers we were getting. Not sincere like we'd been in the old days. And I just, screw AA. It's making me feel worse. So I decided to not go to AA anymore. And I didn't go to AA. 2-3 weeks. I made sure that I watched myself every day to make sure I wasn't going insane. But And after about 2 or 3 weeks, I was thinking, I'm really feeling good. I don't get those whining phone calls. I don't get that crap. And it suddenly struck me. Somehow or other, everyone around me has turned into an asshole. How did that happen? Could it be because I didn't go to AA? And I think that's why old-timers get drunk. Things like that happen, and they say, oh, man, I'm not going back to AA. That's a bunch of crap. But I went back to AA because I'm a generous person to shape you people up. And that's why I go to AA today. I don't need it. But you all need it badly. And as long as I'm here, you'll never be an asshole. I'll tell you that. Thank you.